here today with attorney Rob Mansour, and we're talking about estate planning. But before we do, is there any disclaimers that we should get out of the way right off the bat, Rob?
Well, yes, Jack. Thank you very much. First thing that people should know is that the information that's on this CD is not necessarily good in all 50 states.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be general information, so that's very important for people to know that. I'm a California lawyer,
mm-hmm.
so the information that I have is generally specific to California, but in many cases it works for all 50 states. However, I really encourage anybody listening to this audio program to seek a professional's help if this is something they really want to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, if estate planning is important to do, why do so many people avoid doing it? Can you tell us?
Yeah, I think that one of the biggest obstacles, there are several obstacles that people seem to encounter. The first one is that estate planning is not terribly exciting.
Mm-hmm.
People aren't riveted by estate planning. They'd rather plan their vacation. They'd rather go to Disneyland, listen to a radio program or do something else rather than planning their estate. Some people actually think that if they do estate planning, they're actually hastening their death. That it's actually going to come quicker if they think about it. Another thing that happens is that people put it off. They say, you know, I know it's something important. I know I should do something about it, but I'm too busy. I'm too busy with the kids. I'm too busy at work. Whatever the case may be, they just put it off. And I kid them. I say, look, you're spending so much time creating your estate, but you don't take the time to protect your estate. It's kind mm-hmm. of silly, but that's how it happens. The other thing that people object to is they say that estate planning is something that old people should do.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, I'm not old people, so I don't have to do this right now. And they wait until they're old people, and then sometimes they wait until it's too late. So I tell people, you know, estate planning is something that people can do in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s, etc. There is no time limit on it. And the last objection that people often tell me is they say, well, estate planning is something that someone like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett should do. They have something worth protecting. I don't really have to do it. So those are the kind of things that people tell me, and I think that's why they put it off.
Mm-hmm. So it's never too early to start estate planning.
It is never too early.
What do you mean by the word estate?
Well, the word estate is probably the dumbest thing we ever did as lawyers, is call it estate planning, because the word estate seems to it leads people to believe that they have to live on a big mansion on a big hill somewhere, eating caviar, talking with a British accent in order to have an estate. They think of that kind of an image. They're playing polo, you know, with their friends. And I say, no, an estate is simply your stuff. What is your stuff? And the term estate, I think, misleads a lot of people to think that this is not something for them. But I think it can be misleading in that way. It's just really your stuff.
Why should people do estate planning? Is it really necessary?
Well, I think that it serves several purposes. First of all, after you pass away, if you've created an estate plan of some sort, you get to control who receives your assets after you pass away. You also minimize any legal fees that might be incurred upon your passing, and in some cases you can actually minimize taxes. Some people have heard of inheritance tax, death tax,
mm-hmm.
estate tax.
Mm-hmm.
All of those are pretty much the same thing, and you can minimize those taxes if you plan ahead. Also, the other reason that you might want to do estate planning is that at your incapacity, in the event that you can't handle things yourself, you can control your assets with legal documents. You have a team of people that you love and care for, and you've given them the legal tools that they need to make medical decisions for you, to handle your affairs, to go to the bank for you, to make sure that your assets are handled properly while you're still alive. So not just after you pass away,
mm-hmm.
you're creating something that people can help you with while you're still alive. Also, some people say, you know, do I really have to do this, Rob? I mean, is this something mm-hmm. I really have to do? And I say, look, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to go to the dentist. You don't have to go to the doctor. There's nothing that you have to do. But it makes sense to do it in advance, because it's just like you want to protect your health by going to the dentist, by going to the doctor. You want to protect your estate by going to an attorney. Or if you really, really want to, and I don't advise this, you do it yourself, which I don't advise. But it's something that people should do. And some people say, well, I don't have enough money to do it. I don't have enough things. I don't have enough stuff. And I tell them, look, the less you have, the more you have to lose. So you don't have to have a lot of things to protect it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if Bill Gates were to lose $1 million from his estate, he'd probably be just fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if an average person loses a good 25% of their estate, or thousands in court fees, or thousands to the IRS, that's kind of silly if it could have been prevented. And the final thing is that there are practical reasons to do estate planning. For example, somebody might say, well, I'll just give you an example. I had a client the other day. He came in and he had just gotten a divorce. And the reason that he had gotten a divorce is because his wife couldn't manage money to save her life.
Mm.
And this happens a lot. Financial reasons often lead to divorce. And he says to me, Rob, what if I do nothing? And I said, look, if you do nothing and you remain unmarried, in all likelihood, your estate will end up with your child. And he said, super, that's exactly what I want. And then I stopped him and I said, well, wait a minute, how old is your child? And he says, well, she's 8 years old. I said, well, you realize that nobody's going to give all that money to an 8-year-old. A life insurance company is not going to make a check payable to an 8-year-old. They're going to make it payable to a guardian. I said, who's your child's guardian? He says, oh, my God, my ex-wife. And I said, you see, you might want to create an estate plan so that you don't have all your money go to your ex-spouse upon your passing, that your money would be managed by somebody else for the benefit of your child. So there are sometimes practical reasons to do an estate plan. So those are some reasons why people might want to do estate planning.
So when you say who should be doing estate planning, who exactly are you mentioning?
Well, like we said earlier, there's really no age limit, but there are categories of people. Number one, older citizens need to think about estate planning if they haven't done anything yet. And the truth of the matter is, as we get older, we start to forget things. We start to have concerns about passing away. And we want to make sure that the wealth that we've accumulated passes to the next generation properly. So older citizens, for sure, need to think about it. Also, anybody with a family, children, especially blended families where you might have children from previous relationships that you want to make sure don't get what is called unintentionally disinherited. They lose things simply because there was no planning done in advance. And finally, single people should do estate planning too. And single people often tell me, they say, well, I'm not married and I don't have any kids, so I probably don't need to worry about it, right? And I say, well, actually, since you're single, you probably need to worry about it quite a bit, because you need to make sure that people have the legal documents that they need to help you. You don't have a spouse to fall back on. And in some cases, people don't have parents or close family to fall back on. So it would really be helpful for single people as well to do an estate plan.
So when should people consider creating their plan?
Today. I think they should do it right away, and I'll tell you why. You want to do it while you can. You need to have capacity. You need to have the mental capacity to do estate planning. So that means that you need to understand what you're doing. Sometimes clients call me and they say, my mom and dad are in the hospital. They're suffering from dementia or Alzheimer's disease, and we need to do their estate plan. And I say, I'm really sorry. It's too late, because your parents don't have the capacity that is required for me to legally help you. Also, a notary public, anybody notarizing documents would have to say that these people have capacity to sign and they appreciate what they're doing. So while you can, number two, before you need it. So you want to do it before you need it so that you're not scrambling to create an estate plan. You want to do it while you have the mental focus to do so, because people tend to put it as a back burner item. And I always tell clients, don't call me from the hospital, because it's too late. Mm-hmm. Almost always it's too late if you're calling me from the hospital. And there is no second chance. You know, nobody really knows when something's going to happen, when a tragedy is going to befall the family. So I tell clients, look, don't wait until something happens and then try to correct it. It's almost always better to plan ahead. And, of course, the famous saying is, failing to plan is planning to fail.
Mm-hmm. We often think of a will to do at the end, but it's really something we have to do now, before that happens.
That's right.
So what about a will? Isn't that enough?
Well, a lot of people think that a will is enough, and in some cases it might be. There are certain thresholds in every state where a will would be appropriate before a living trust, for example, might be appropriate. But a will, and I tell clients this, a will is nothing more than a wish list of where you want your things to go after you pass away. It is of absolutely no use to you while you're still alive. Your family cannot use your will to assist you while you are still alive. It only goes into effect after you pass away. Also, a will only controls assets that are in your name alone. A will has to go through probate court. And probate court is, people say, well, what is this probate thing that you're talking about? It is the court-supervised transfer of your assets. So you have a wish list, but you still have to go through this expensive court process that often takes a year or so to go through. And a will is nice, but it doesn't avoid that, and a lot of people really want to avoid that. And probate fees can be very, very cumbersome. Mm-hmm. For example, it can be about 5% of the gross estate. Mm. So on an $800,000 estate, let's say, for example, you have a house, just a house that's worth $800,000, you're looking at about, you know, $40,000 in all kinds of fees, court fees, appraiser fees, lawyer fees. And a will is almost a guarantee that you're going to be going through the probate process, which is very expensive. And the last thing I want to say about a will is that many people think that a will controls everything, that it controls your life insurance, that it controls your IRAs, your 401ks. They think it controls all your bank accounts. It doesn't necessarily do that. There are many things that a will has nothing to do with at all.
Hmm. You mentioned probate. Can you elaborate what exactly is probate?
Yes. It is the, like I said earlier, and I'll expound upon it, it is the court supervising where your stuff is going to go. So, for example, let's say I were to pass away today, and my wife also passes away. Our kids simply cannot put a for sale sign, that is, on our lawn. They can't just sell the house. Number one, they're minors. Number two, they don't own my home, so they don't have the legal right to sell my home. So somebody's got to supervise the transfer of that asset to my kids. And no one will talk to my kids. No broker is going to help them, no title company, because they're going to want to see a court order. They're going to want to see something from a judge saying that, yes, this property belongs to these people. And this can be anybody in your life, too. It doesn't have to be, you know, your kids. And so the judge has to supervise the transfer of that asset, and not just that asset. It can include automobiles, bank accounts, a variety of things have to go through that process before the various institutions will actually allow that asset to go to whomever you want it to go to. And that's assuming that you've even at least created a will telling the judge where you want things to go. So the process essentially is about 12 months long. In some states it can be longer. Sometimes it can be shorter. The will needs to be validated. The court first needs to accept that this is actually a will, and it's actually written by the person who allegedly wrote it. Debts must be paid. Creditors need to get involved. And it's really the only legal way to change title if you haven't done any estate planning up front.
So does everything have to go through probate?
No. Generally, only assets that are in your name alone. If you own assets jointly with somebody, the asset will simply pass to the joint survivor. The survivor of the two people who's still alive generally will get that asset. So not everything has to go through probate, but many things do, and it's very costly and very time-consuming.
You mentioned cost and time. Exactly how long does the probate process take?
Well, like I said earlier, it could be as little as 6 months, but that's really hopeful. I have found that probates that I'm handling tend to run about 12 months or so. And that's assuming there are no problems. There's no sibling objecting to the probate, no sibling quarreling with other siblings. I mean, people often tell me, they say, oh, my family, we all get along very, very well. And I tell them, look, probate court is full of people who used to get along very, very well. And so they're there now and they're arguing about mom's vase, about mom and dad's house, about what to do with the cars. And all of a sudden, what should take 6 months could end up taking a year or even longer. And also, the process is very cumbersome, and it's limited by the court's resources. So the judge may not be able to see your case or hear your case as quickly because they're just backlogged, and they have too much going on. And as I mentioned earlier, the cost could be roughly 5% of the gross estate, not the net, but the gross estate. And that surprises a lot of people because it can cost quite a bit of money to go through that process.
Well, are there any other downsides to probate?
Well, first of all, there's no privacy. It's an open court. Everything is filed with the court. Anybody can show up to the court proceeding. It's easy to contest. So let's say, for example, there's a disgruntled family member. All they have to do is show up at the court hearing and say, Your Honor, I object for the following reasons, blah, blah, blah. They don't have to do anything except just show up to the court hearing. And they even get notice of all the court hearings. They're legally required to get notice of those court hearings. So it's I tell people it's like it's almost like an invitation for disgruntled family members to come to court and object and make a lot of noise. And, you know, the fact that it's a public process discourages a lot of people, and they would rather make things private by doing a proper estate plan.
So let me give you a hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
What if a person becomes incapacitated and can no longer take care of their affairs? What happens?
Well, if they have just a will, let's assume that they have just a will, that's of no help at all, because we've already decided, or already discussed, rather, that a will only goes into effect after you die. So if you're incapacitated, nobody can use a will to help you. If you have no estate planning documents in place, like a durable power of attorney, or an advance health care, or in some states it's called a living will, if you don't have these kinds of documents in place, then what often happens is that your loved ones are forced to take you to court and get the court involved. In California, it's generally called a conservatorship. You might have heard of guardians for children. A conservatorship is like a guardian for an adult. And what happens is institutions don't want to deal with this individual because they're incapacitated. They can't make their own decisions, and so they don't know who to look to. So what they're waiting for is a court to appoint somebody to that position, and conservatorships can be very expensive and quite embarrassing, because literally the individual must be declared incompetent, which means that there are doctor's declarations, there are doctor examinations,
mm-hmm.
The court sends their own examiner, their own investigation, so it can be very embarrassing for the family and very costly, and sometimes can take several months, if not longer, to accomplish.
What happens to children who are minors?
Well, basically the same problem. If children are minors and there are no guardians nominated by the parents, anybody who wants to can get in line to take care of those kids. So you got to get the court involved to appoint guardians for those children. Also, the court may actually oversee the finances, and the guardian has to report to the court regularly, letting the judge know what's going on with the children's finances. The courts are very, very careful when it comes to children. I have a client right now whose husband passed away. He had no will, no nothing. And so according to California law, he has two children. They get two-thirds of the property, and she gets one-third. But even though she's their mother, she still has to go to court and get appointed to be their guardian. And she has to report to the court regularly about what's going on with the kids' money. She has to document everything. It's a real hassle and very expensive. And the final wrinkle to all this is once the children turn 18 years of age, mm-hmm. at least in California, they are legally entitled to all of their money, all of their inheritance. Mm-hmm. So if you have nothing set up in place, the children could legally demand their money, their inheritance, at the age of 18. And for some kids, that may not be the best idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's assume for the moment someone simply decides to simply do nothing. No estate plan whatsoever.
Oh, yeah.
What about that approach?
That is probably the most, I call it the do-nothing approach.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the most popular approach because, number one, it's very easy. Number two, it's free. You don't have to do anything. And if that is your approach, then at your death, probate is most likely going to occur, that court process that I talked about earlier. Your assets will be distributed pursuant to state law, not pursuant to your wishes. And I always tease people. I say, look, if you don't write a will, the state of California will write one for you. It's already written. It says who gets what and under what circumstances, et cetera. So, you know, if you're comfortable with that, then do nothing. If you would rather control where things go and how they go, then I suggest you plan ahead. And finally, if you do nothing, as I mentioned earlier, if you're incapacitated, you're almost certain to be talking court involvement to get a conservatorship or a guardianship or something of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Good point. What if people own property jointly? Doesn't that avoid any problems?
Well, yes. A lot of people think that joint ownership is the solution to all of the things that they're concerned about. They say, well, I know. If my wife and I own something jointly, or me and my friend Bob own something jointly, then that solves the problem, because if I die, the survivor gets the entire asset. And that is true, technically true. However, there are some problems, because joint ownership, as I mentioned, is very common, but it can be also very dangerous to do. It is the last man or last woman standing gets the entire asset. Mm-hmm. So let's say, for example, three people own a piece of property. The last person alive gets that whole piece of property because they own it jointly. But what you are really doing is, number one, you lose control over that asset. You'd lose any say in where that asset goes because, after all, the last person alive gets to control that asset. Number two, you're simply postponing probate because at some point, somewhere, there's going to be one person left on that asset. If you own it jointly as a husband and wife, for example, at one point, either the wife is owning it alone or the husband is owning it alone. And in that case, you're going to be going through the probate process. So all you've really done is postpone it. And I tell sometimes clients, you know, some clients will come and say, I know, I will put my children on title with me to my home. I'm going to add Billy, my son, to my house, and therefore when I die, Billy will get my home. And I said, well, that's true, but is that really what you want to do? Because anytime you add a joint owner to an asset, you've put a bullseye on that asset. You are subjecting that asset to that individual's problems, that individual's creditors, that individual's debtors. If they get into problems, a lawsuit, for example, that asset becomes fair game because their name is on it. And so I tell people, why do you want to add bullseyes to your asset when there are other ways to get that property to people that are much safer to do? Also, once you put a joint owner on your asset, you can't just take them off yourself. You can't just say, you know what, I don't like Billy anymore and I don't want him to be on my asset. Billy's got to do it. You can't take them off. They have to affirmatively do it themselves, and in many cases they don't want to, because after all, they own it now and they want a piece of that action. And in some cases, let's say, for example, your joint owner becomes incapacitated. Well, the court may get involved, and suddenly you and the court own a piece of property together or own a bank account together. And so you can't really do anything without the court's involvement if your joint owner becomes incapacitated. There's a couple of other things I want to mention, Jack, too, about joint ownership. Number one is the cost basis problem. If you put somebody on title with you on an asset, they assume your cost basis for that asset. So let's say, for example, mom wants to put her son on title with her to her real estate. But let's say, for example, the house was bought by mom and she only paid $100,000 for it back many, many years ago. Now, the idea is that her son is going to take over that asset. But by putting him on title, he has absorbed her cost basis for that asset.
Mm-hmm.
So when he comes to sell that asset, assuming mom passes away and he now owns it, he comes to sell it for, say, $800,000 or $900,000 because the house has appreciated. He has to pay capital gains tax from $100,000 all the way to whatever he sells it for. Whereas if he simply inherited the property from his mother, it would have gotten a full step up in basis, and he would have been able to avoid a lot of capital gains taxes. But unfortunately, when you put somebody on title with you, they absorb your cost basis. And two other things I want to mention here. Leaving all of your assets, what a lot of people do, I should say, is that they leave everything to their spouse, for example. But this could lead to something what I call, remember I talked about unintentional disinheritance. This can lead to unintentional disinheritance, and I'll tell you how it works. Let's say, for example, the wife passes away, and her husband is left owning the piece of real estate. If he marries somebody new, the new wife, I should say, the new wife, and he puts her on as a joint owner with him. But then he passes away. Guess who owns everything? The new wife. The new wife now owns everything because she was put on as a joint owner. And that can lead to unintentional consequences, and maybe the new wife doesn't want to leave everything to the kids, and maybe she has her own kids from a previous relationship she would rather leave that asset to. So joint ownership is probably the biggest culprit of what I call unintentionally disinheriting your loved ones, because last man standing gets the asset.
Well, what do you mean that joint ownership simply postpones probate?
Well, like I said, let's say Tom and Ann own a piece of property together, and Tom passes away, but they own it jointly. By operation of law, Ann now owns the entire property because they owned it as joint tenants or joint owners. Well, at some point, like I said, Ann is now the only owner of this parcel of property. When she dies, that property now has to go through that court process called probate. So all we've done is postpone the inevitable.
Well, can't people just give away their assets?
Well, that is something that a lot of people do. They say, I know, I'll just start to give stuff away. First of all, you can't give things away to anybody that you want as much as you want. Between husband and wife, you can gift an unlimited amount of money back and forth. That's something that husbands and wives kind of have as a special bonus of being married. However, if you want to give to your kids, or you want to give to cousins, or you want to give to family members, other family members, there are limits, at least in California, there are limits to how much money you can gift in any particular year without having to file a gift tax return. So there are limits to it. Also, number two, if you gift something away, you've lost control of it. Mm-hmm. You no longer have that item. You've given it away to somebody else. You've lost control of it. If you need it back, if you need some money back or a parcel of property back, it may not be all that easy to get it back from the person that you gifted it to. And also the same issue about cost basis. If you gift somebody an asset, they absorb your cost basis for that asset. So let's say, for example, mom wants to gift the property to her son, not put him on title, but gift it to him. He will still absorb the cost basis, the amount that she paid for that property,
mm-hmm.
which could lead, again, to very significant capital gains tax. So gifting is not always the best idea, although it can be helpful in some estates.
Now, what if people simply use beneficiary designations to transfer their assets?
Beneficiary designations are quite popular, and there's really nothing wrong with it. It's very common on, for example, tax-deferred accounts like retirement accounts, 401ks, IRAs. Those kinds of things often pass by way of beneficiary. And frankly, if you have no significant concerns about it, it's often a very good way to go for tax reasons. But there are many assets that you cannot have passed by way of beneficiary. In California, for example, we don't have it where you can pass real estate by way of beneficiary. Also, I tell clients, look, what if the beneficiary that you want to give the asset to becomes incapacitated? Then what? It probably won't pass to that individual that easily. The court will have to get involved. Also, what if the beneficiary that you've designated dies before you or dies at the same time? That may not be the best idea. And also, if your beneficiary is a minor, the court will certainly get involved because a guardian will have to be named for that individual, for that minor, before anybody will pay any money out to them.
Now, you mentioned a living trust. How can that help?
Well, a living trust is a very neat document, and it's appropriate for many people. In California, for example, it may be appropriate for people who own real estate or who have above a certain threshold of money. And every state is different. But a trust, I tell people to think of a living trust like a contract. And it can be a living trust for a sole individual or a joint couple, for example, can do a living trust. And you outline what happens with your estate, what happens with your stuff, and who gets your stuff, so to speak, and under what circumstances. Mm-hmm. And who will be in charge of your estate in the event that you can no longer handle your own circumstances, your own affairs. So a living trust is a very neat tool, and anything in your living trust is governed by your living trust.
Now, what do you mean when you say put things in the trust?
That's a very good question, Jack, and a lot of people ask me that. They say, what do you mean putting things in a trust? And when I say put things in a trust, I mean you're changing title to the asset. So, mm-hmm. for example, instead of the house being owned by Robert Mansour, okay, myself, it would be owned by Robert Mansour, trustee of the Robert Mansour Living Trust. Same thing with all my bank accounts. And by changing the title on those assets now become governed by my living trust and the rules that I've set out in my living trust.
But don't you lose control of things that are in the names of the trust?
Again, a very common question. You don't lose control because not only have you created the trust, but oftentimes you are the initial trustee of your own trust. So you call the shots just like you did before. You go to the bank and do things just like you did before, but instead of being an individual, acting as an individual, you are now acting as the trustee of your trust. But otherwise, you almost, in most cases, have all the same control as before.
What about children? How can a living trust help?
Well, in my case, for example, I have a 9-year-old and an 11-year-old. And the truth is, I don't want them to get all of mommy and daddy's money right away. So in a living trust, I can actually control when and under what circumstances my children get their inheritance. For example, you can choose different ages. you could say, you know what, I want my kids to get one-third at a certain age, and then another third at another age, and then finally, let's say at the age of 35, they can get the balance of the estate. And the reason is that sometimes children, if they inherit money, they can use it foolishly. It can be mismanaged. If they get it at a young age, they could be under the influence of peers, girlfriends, boyfriends. In some cases also, you may have a son or daughter who is married to somebody that you're not terribly crazy about. And if you give the money to your kid, it may end up in the hands of that spouse who may become an ex-spouse at some point, and suddenly your inheritance is going to people that you never intended. So you want to name a trustee, a person that you trust to manage your affairs for you and make sure that the money gets to the kids at the proper intervals and under the proper circumstances.
We've touched on some important points. Perhaps for our listeners, we should summarize the benefits.
Yes, a living trust, number one, anything in the name of the trust will avoid probate. That's one of the beautiful features of a living trust. Remember, we talked about how expensive probate is and how much time it takes. So a living trust avoids probate. And number two, it also prevents court involvement if you're incapacitated. If you're incapacitated, your trustee, your successor trustee, that is, the person that you've named in advance, will now handle your affairs for you. Oftentimes, spouses name each other first in line for each other, which is fine, and then they name a trusted friend or a trusted family member after that. And I always tell people it's a good idea to come up with two or three successors.
Mm-hmm.
Think of it like the vice president of the United States. If anything happened to the president of the United States, the vice president steps in and starts managing everything. The country doesn't just fall apart, and the court doesn't have to get involved generally. Also, a living trust ensures privacy. You don't have to go to court for assets that are held in a living trust. So you know you don't have that public nature, if you will. Everything is held private within the family, which a lot of people really like. It also allows for a quick distribution of your assets. If your living trust calls for a distribution of your assets, the court doesn't have to get involved. You don't have to wait that 1 year in probate. You know, there's a wrinkle here that I want to mention, and I'm reminded of it. Let's say, for example, you pass away and your asset is going through probate, your house, for example. Your mortgage payment is still due. The mortgage company might grieve for a few seconds that you passed away, but they want their mortgage mm-hmm. payment every month.
Mm-hmm.
And for a family to have to wait a year or longer and continue to pay these monthly payments can be very, very difficult for them, especially if there's not enough liquid money. So a living trust helps avoid that and expedites the distribution of assets. Also, assets that remain in the trust can be protected from creditors. They can be protected from spendthrift children, spendthrift relatives. Make sure your children get their assets at appropriate ages. You can, depending on the kind of trust that you have, reduce or in some cases eliminate those estate taxes that I mentioned earlier, death taxes, inheritance taxes. The federal government basically wants a piece of the action if you have too much money when you pass away. And there are certain kind of trusts that we can create that will help reduce or in some cases eliminate those taxes. And finally, keep in mind that a living trust is helpful, but it's just one document of a larger estate plan.
Now, what else is part of a typical estate plan?
Well, for my clients, I explain to them that a living trust is often the center of the plan. They would also need a will. And they say to me, well, wait a minute, Rob, why do I need a will if I have a living trust? And I explain to them that it's a special kind of will. It's called a pour-over will. And a pour-over will simply means that if you forgot an asset and that asset has to go through the probate process, through the court system, your will directs the judge to pour that asset over into your living trust, hence the name pour-over will. Also, many of my clients, I explain to them that they're going to need a health care directive. And in California, it's called an advance health care directive. In many other places, it's called a living will. And in this document, you name an individual or more individuals to make health care decisions for you if you cannot make them yourself. And also, there are lots of privacy laws out there now where hospitals and doctors don't just release your medical records. You got to have special language in your health care directive to allow those facilities to release your medical records to your loved ones. And the last part, the last major document that goes into an estate plan is a solid, durable power of attorney. And that document allows your agents, the people who you've named, to basically act for you in virtually every other circumstance. They can deal with your human resources department. They can deal with the IRA company. They can deal with your life insurance company. They can talk to the bank, your credit card companies. These institutions will not talk to these people unless they have the legal documents necessary that allow them to stand in your place and to act on your behalf. So those are some of the main documents that go into a typical estate plan. I mean, there's several others, but like, for example, a nomination of guardian for your children. Also, depending on the nature of property, you might want to have a community property agreement between you and your spouse. If you have separate property, you want to make sure that's outlined in your estate plan. So there are a handful of other documents that go into it as well, Jack.
Rob, you mentioned quite a bit here: probate, will, living trust, estate plans. What should I do now? What would the listeners, what would be something they should do right now?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question because that's exactly what people say. They say, well, now what? I'm convinced. I think this is something important that I should do. What should I do next? The first thing you should do is contact an attorney, somebody qualified to assist you in developing your estate plan. And number two, you basically are going to make an appointment with that lawyer. The lawyer will probably send you a questionnaire of sorts that you need to fill out, because for the lawyer to give you advice, they need to review your situation. Just like if you go to a doctor, they need to examine you first before they give you a diagnosis and a recommendation. So the same thing with the law. Now, if a lawyer doesn't ask you for information in advance and doesn't ask you for documents, you should be a little concerned, because that lawyer might be giving you some cookie-cutter documents that have nothing to do with your particular situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I've reviewed many estate plans, Jack, where people come in with documents that are totally inappropriate for them. When I tell them what the documents actually say, they are aghast. They can't believe that they were sold these things. So the lawyers will sit down with the client at the first meeting, and they will review the questionnaire together. The lawyer will make recommendations. Generally speaking, then the lawyer will then draft the documents, and it's about 2 to 4 weeks. The client will get the documents and should review them to make sure they really do capture what they want. And then there's often what's called the signing appointment, where the documents are signed and notarized, etc. And then the client now has the legal tools that they need. And just like going to the doctor, the same analogy, you should go to the doctor every few years to get a checkup, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the same thing with a lawyer. I tell my clients to come in at least every 3 years to make sure that things are still on track, that there haven't been any dramatic changes in the law that affect them, or dramatic changes in their family situation that call for any kind of revision of the documents. So I think it's something they should check on every few years.
Is there a way that our listeners can get in contact with you, or is there also anything that our listeners else should know?
Well, yes. I think that the listeners to this audio program should walk away with one thing. You don't have to be extremely wealthy to create an estate plan. An estate is your stuff, and you want to make sure that your stuff gets to the right people with the least amount of legal hassle and the least amount of cost. And also, you want to make sure that your loved ones have the documents they need to help you in the case that you can't help yourself. So that's what I want them to walk away with. How can they get in touch with me? They can always go to my website, which is mansoorlaw.com. My last name is spelled M-A-N-S-O-U-R, and then the word law, L-A-W.com. And if they want to email me or give me a call with some questions, I'd be happy to.
Well, Rob, this has been extremely informative. Thank you so much for coming in. I know our listeners will all benefit from the information you just given.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you very much.
Okay.